Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Izzy of Black Honey and we have a delightful chat about wonderful records and all that kind of stuff that you've come to love from this podcast. Speaking of which, we've gone over 500 episodes and I just wanted to say a huge thank you for your ongoing support of this podcast. It's been going a few years now. It was kind of got me through lockdown and I hope it kind of helped you, you know, distract yourself from what was going on during lockdown as well. I've had bursts of releasing two episodes a week for a few years and I guess I'm just putting out the one episode a week for free at the moment. But you can support the podcast and get loads more content and watch the episodes as well over on Patreon. And that's patreon.com/offthebeatandtrack. So what is this Patreon thing that he bangs on about every week? This is the bit you all skip past anyway. But basically, it's almost like a sort of crowdfunding thing where basically I ask you to pay $1 a month. So whatever that is, 75p a month. And then for that, you get to watch all the episodes ad-free and you get upfront releases, you get access to an archive of probably another 500 episodes of radio shows and mixtapes. And what you also get is access to the monthly live show. And that's so much fun. We do it over Zoom just a delightful bunch of humans join it every month and we have a lovely little chat. We're recording one, it probably would have happened by the time this episode comes out, but we're recording one. The next one we're talking about film scores and soundtracks and not in a, yeah, I'm really into Morricone. I'm sure we're just going to be talking about really lovely nostalgic film soundtracks and scores that have kind of hit home with us. It's not a snooty, elitist thing. It's just a really nice hangout with some wonderful people that all have very different tastes in music. So it makes for a lovely hour spent once a month. And I'd love you to come and experience that and join in. And it's your opportunity to get your voice on Off the Beaten Track. I think I've released a few of the episodes for free. So go and have a look in the archives. And while you're over there, why not subscribe? And why not get stuck into the archives of this podcast? Because you have missed loads. I mean, blimey, who have I had on over the past? I'm going to try my best not to mention the Foo Fighters and Motley Crue and the Killers, because they're the ones I do all the time, because they're the ones that just pop up at the front of me brain. Right, Charlie Higson of The Fast Show. Recently, the delightful Hugo White of the Maccabees and 86 TVs. Guy Pratt of Pink Floyd. Go check that out. Recently, I had Rob on from Enter Shikari. I've had Napalm Death on recently. Who else have I had on? I've got a little list here. I'm just trying to flick through them. King Creosote I had on lately. He was a fantastic guest. And you know all about the archives, the Swades and the Kaiser Chiefs and all of that lot. Go the Kooks. They've all been on. And why not just go and explore that back catalogue? Right. I've been banging on for nearly 4 minutes now, and we've not even got on to today's episode. Just lastly, you know, big love to you lot for listening and for supporting the pod. Thanks so much. Also, big shout out to Tom for Tom Dark, wonderful man who helped put this arrange this podcast. This podcast is produced by the team at Blue Murder Club Pod. If you like your true crime, go and check out the Blue Murder Club podcast. And I'd like to thank Mr. Scroobius Pippikins and everybody else over at the Distraction Pieces Network, home of some ace pods, and I feel proud to be part of it. Please enjoy today's episode of Off the Beaten Track podcast with Black Honey.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Hey, we are recording. Izzy, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. I mean, we've already had a little natter before we've pressed record, and we've established that I'm in my shed with about 15 layers on, and you've not been able to go surfing today because there's been a bit of a sandstorm in what looks to be a gloriously warm country.
Yeah, it's a hard life.
Wonderful. Well, look, thanks ever so much for coming on today. I always kick off the podcast with the same question. And Izzy, I'm going to ask you to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
So for this song, I have chosen, just to get it up on my to-do list. So the greatest song for an intro for me was 20th Century Boy by T-Rex. I heard a rumor once that the reason why this intro sounds so good is because the guitars in it are like not actually like in tune with each other, and someone tried to re-record it and put the guitars in tune, and it just didn't sound as good. I just feel like it's like I can't explain the feeling that it gives me, because I guess the reason my music is so good is because you can't vocalize what it does that speaks to you. But this song for me makes me feel like it feels like a surge of energy or like a surge of power that you're kind of like pulling from yourself.
Yeah,
is how I guess I could describe it, but that's the best I got. I think
that's fantastic. I mean, that kind of crunch of that guitar before it all kicks in is well, obviously you know what it is right from the off, and it's pretty sort of, as is much of Boland's stuff, it's very instant. That the intros are all pretty short,
yeah,
and to the point, and kind of really set the standard for what you're going to get for the rest of the song. Izzy, I want to ask you about intros, and you're releasing music now at a time where there's far different factors in place to what Boland had, which was probably trying to get on the radio and maybe getting on Top of the Pops, you know, and I think as a Top of the Pops has long gone, and you know, and I guess alternative radio stations playing guitar music are few and far between these days as well. And so what we're seeing now is a lot of kind of emphasis on, you know, getting on the right Spotify playlists and such. And what you're also seeing, you know, is the sort of power of things like TikTok. And I just wonder how many of them kind of trends in things like TikTok and trying to grab people instantly because attention spans seem to be dwindling and getting shorter and shorter. How much of that filters through into your creative process?
Probably more than I'd like to admit. I definitely feel the sort of chokehold of like the get to the chorus before the first 30 seconds of a song. And like, it's funny that I should pick this like Mark Bolan intro, because he literally like is smashing, he would smash TikTok with this intro. Like, this would be like, I don't know, like an outfit choice song that people would probably use to strut down the street with. But I definitely think like growing up in the times when like 90s had like massive intros that were just 30 seconds, and now you have to get to a chorus in 30 seconds, it is really weird to adjust to. But then when you cut back to something like this from before then, and you think, oh, this packs a punch every every step of the way. And I think, like, I find that really inspiring, that like it doesn't have to compromise the art form if you have an intro that packs a punch. Or like it can, like, I always get nervous with an intro. It's like, God, if I'd written that song as an intro, I don't know how I'd have like followed it with the rest of the song. Like, how do you literally beat that?
you talk about the sort of power of the intro, and you know, in the 90s, and did you hear the T-Rex version before you heard Placebo's version? Because Placebo had a huge hit with that in the mid-90s. I just wondered if that was something that was on your radar before Bolan, or did you get Bolan first?
Now you say it, I'm like, I do think I can hear his Placebo voice singing that.
It's hard to tell the difference. It's as far as like covers go, it's pretty much like for like.
That's
interesting. I think
that's
they recorded it for the Velvet Goldmine movie, that kind of glam movie.
No way, love that film.
Yeah, and I think Placebo are performing it in the film as well.
So I don't know if I glitched out then or...
It's okay, you're all good.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, I'll tell you what I'm going to do.
Am I coming through? It's frozen on my end.
Oh, really? You're sounding okay to me and I can see you. So can you hear me?
Okay, cool.
Wonderful.
Yeah, you're coming back now.
Okay, great. Izzy, I'm going to ask you for track two, which is the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
So the first song that I remember hearing that had an emotional impact on me was Yesterday by the Beatles. I was in year two. I'm going to say year two or maybe year three. And we had to actually do it in our music class. And like up until this day, we had had, I think it was recorder or Casio keyboard group lessons in that music class, which, as you can imagine, was just like hell. But this time our teacher, I think our teacher was like despairing with the class and just like not getting anywhere. And he brought in Yesterday by the Beatles and like made us listen to it as a piece of music and kind of contemplate its meaning or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just remember feeling like really, really sad and thinking, oh my goodness, the man's voice, you know, I didn't even know it was like Macca. Do you know what I mean? Back then I was just like, this man, I really understand the feeling of something gone past yesterday that you can no longer touch. Or I imagined that yesterday was the feeling of what you would have if someone died. And all you wanted was to see them again, or a friend that you missed, or the real sort of homesickness that you feel with love and loss. And it spoke to me in a way that I hadn't ever had music speak to me before. So I suddenly felt like this kind of awakening to, like, through music you can feel things. And you don't really understand it at the time, but then going forward now in time, I can't remember another example of when something hit me so sort of strikingly. And I don't think I ever had that feeling again where I was just like, oh my God, wow, yeah, I get it, because of how he said something.
While we're sort of talking about those formative years in music, tell me a little bit about where was home and where you grew up, and was home a musical place?
Home was definitely not a musical place for me, but there was like glimpses of it. I think there was a piano in our dining room, and my dad claimed to have played trumpet, although I think I saw him play trumpet like maybe twice in my life. Then there was a 12-string acoustic guitar in the house, which I just felt really confused by. It had never struck me as something that felt interesting. I just didn't understand why it always sounded so horrible. Like, at least with the piano, you could kind of find your way around it. Whereas with this guitar, I just felt like, this just sounds horrible. And it was obviously just really out of tune 12 strings, obviously, like with no chord played on it. I was just like, now I know why it sounded so bad. But I remember always being really creative and really arty, And I remember watching my dad's hands once when he played piano and learning a piece from watching him play.
Okay.
I remember that. And I remember saying in, I think it was after we did a school nativity once, someone saying that I had a good ear for music. And I said, what does a good ear mean? And he said, oh, it means that you've got a good inner ear, like inside your ear can hear the music really well. You can hear the notes well. And I remember thinking like, oh, I've got a good ear. That's cool. Like, I didn't really know what it meant, but I was like, oh, this is exciting.
Stick that on the CV.
And then I guess like I did the sort of usual route of like, I played a bit of recorder in 1 year, and then they asked us what instrument we wanted to play. And I said, I wanted to learn the harp, because we went to a family barbecue once and this girl was playing the harp in the garden. And I was like, so mesmerized by this like magical instrument. And so when they said, what do you want to play? I said, the harp. And they said, oh, well, we don't think we know anyone that teaches the harp around here. So you can learn the flute if you want. How's the flute sound? And I was like, yeah, okay. The flute sounds cool. Like my friend Emma was learning flute as well. And it was just like the most miserable instrument ever. Like it was just like so boring. And like it was, took me ages and ages and ages to move up from that. You start on this one called like the fife, which is like a little kids mm-hmm. one, and then you move up to the flute and you're like, oh great. And then all of it was sight read. No one played me a song once. No one literally played me a record and was like, this is what a flute should sound like. Like nothing was done by ear. I was just all reading, and I can't read. I'm a dyslexic, like I can't read anyway. So like someone literally making me read music for me was just so counterintuitive. And I remember like there's one piece that I got on grade 3, which was like minuet in D. And I could like sing you in. I was like, da 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 da. Like I could sing you that now, because I remember having played it so many times for an exam or something that I then learned the melody after I'd sight read it. So sort of in a backwards way, learned the music how I learn music now. But I'm so sort of like, I'm so sad in a way that I never learned it in a way that was fun, because I would have so much better connected with it as a creative exercise if I was taught it in a way that felt exciting. So I guess that was it. And then having literally, I can't even really remember records being played at home. Maybe sometimes like dad would have like classical music on in the car. I was traumatized by my mum playing Enya. To this day I can't listen to it. It gives me like an eye twitch. Like
you and me like, both, mum, mate.
Mom is like, music just happens to somebody else. Like one year I bought her loads of records of like what I thought she would like 1 year, and she just like listened to those same 5 records for like 25 years. Like there's never been much of a thing. But maybe when I was like older or something, I got into music on my own through the kids at school, and like got into like pop music or like pop punk, and then like grunge, and then like through school and listening and conversations there, I sort of found these things, and then got obsessed with like Kerrang magazine or like Enemy, and then that's it. And then going to Virgin and listening to all of the sample decks. I can remember doing that, and like remember like getting an iPod, and like I remember downloading stuff for the first time, and that was really where my musical journey started, because it was so just boring and like so like nothing at home felt like inspired or anything. And then I get jealous of my friends, you know, I've got really close friends who all grow up in these kind of like jazz households that all played in like a family band together.
Yeah.
And I get so envious of that, because I think, God, I wish I'd had that. Like I was so out on the sticks. But then someone said to me the other day that, well, imagine like maybe if you had that, you wouldn't have had this sort of like thirst and this hunger to discover music on your own terms and go on your own personal journey to kind of find this stuff. I mean, to this day, I'm not even sure mum has a clue like what's going on. Like she comes to gigs and I'm like, this is a good one to come to. She's like, I couldn't see you from the back row. I'm like, mum, this boy Liam Gallagher, you're supposed to be excited. She'd be like, oh, I couldn't see you from the back row. Couldn't see you.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I mean, we're talking now a little bit about them sort of, you know, you said there where you started to maybe sort of, you know, make friends at school and almost find your tribe through music. So for the next track, tell me about the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
So, I think, let me just check my notes. Yeah, for this one, I picked Blue Orchid by the White Stripes. Mm-hmm. So I remember seeing Meg White on MTV and in the sort of videos that the White Stripes did, probably before Blue Orchid came out, mm-hmm. playing. And I've just thought, wow, what she does is so amazing. And like, I want to do my version of that, but like with women. And I thought I invented like women in music. I was like, then obviously after that, I discovered like Blondie and Patti Smith and like all my greats. By the time I was like, I'm going to invent the idea of women in music. I just like remember when Blue Orchid like came out and it was like peak White Stripes era, and I just there was something so feral about Jack White that felt like when I saw him, because he was like this Tim Burton creature, this character, I just felt like I saw it and I was like, oh, that's me, like that's me. And then just like we would sing Blue Orchid, me and my two friends. I just had this memory of being on a beach holiday in Wales, in like with, and my friends were there, and I remember being on the beach where we would just like sing the riff of Blue Orchid at each other and be like, and just be like running around things that. And I think there's something like this sticks in your head, that those artists always stick with you in a way, don't they? I mean, I still love Jack White. I'm still sort of in awe of him. I think he's one of our greats. And I don't think he's ever compromised. And now I look back, I'm like, wow, that's so... It's so cool that I got to have that as a kid. Like, that's such a sick thing that I got to have.
Yeah. Tell me about school. Was that something that you enjoyed?
Sorry, glitched out. What did you say?
Tell me about school, Izzy. Was it something that you enjoyed?
Oh, I actually hated school. School was like this system that like other people had just like invented that I was supposed to be enjoying, and everyone would say to me, oh, your school years are the happiest years of your life. And I just remember thinking, fuck me, if this is the happiest years of my life, then I'd rather die. Like, I'd literally rather die. And like every day of my life now as an adult, I walk past schools and I think, holy shit, I got out. I escaped. Like, I literally feel like it was like this kind of chokehold thing where I need to be able to be in. Like, now as an adult, I'm like, it was a place where I couldn't cope with. I couldn't cope with that setting.
Yeah.
And I think like it's hard to conceive the idea that people can just do school and not struggle with it. Like, that's almost harder for me to get my head around, that some people can literally just go to school and be like, oh, I did enjoy it and I did well and I had no problems and I quite liked it. And I'm like, oh my god, like every waking day of that was horrible for me. And I'd find like pleasure in like specific classes like art or theater or English when it was literature, or when we got to do creative writing, you know, I'd find my pleasures in it. And I like games a lot. But I really just I couldn't cope with it, to be honest with you. I had really bad behavior problems. You know, it was, you can pay me like money to relive it now.
Yeah.
Like I'd still rather have not be there.
Yeah. Did you know what you wanted to be when you was at school?
I knew it was something in music, and I tried learning bass once, and that didn't feel right. Though I really enjoyed it, I found it really hard to write songs on basses, but I didn't know I wanted to write songs for ages, but I know that something didn't feel right. And then later on, I felt like as soon as I started to write songs, I realized, oh, this is what I should be doing. And so I knew I had creative talent, and I really liked the idea of doing music, but I didn't know how to do it. And I didn't really feel like I had any sort of talent for it. Or the kids that did have talent for it were like really obviously good at it.
Yeah.
But so it was kind of like a slow piecing together of like the idea of wanting to do something that you weren't really sure if you could do or was possible, but give it a go, I guess.
So with that in mind, like where was school, and did it feel in that area that it was a realistic, you know, opportunity and dream to pursue, you know, to be a successful musician?
Yeah, so I went to school in this place called Hurst, which was private school, and it was like, I don't think everyone from private school seems to go and do like business stuff, although turns out like loads of the music industry did go to private school now, which is like quite an interesting facet of the whole thing. Had a scholarship there, but and everyone was exceptional at everything, I guess. But I don't know if there was like culture. I don't really remember that. But then when I was in sixth form, I went to like a school that was like a performing arts school. And that one, it was like everyone was super talented. Everyone was like record deal vibes and stuff. And that was a really healthy environment in terms of like not expecting to just have a massive career because you like music. It was a really like good lesson, and like there's a lot of kids out there that are a lot more talented than you, so like you got to work really hard if you want to like find your place and find your way. So I really enjoyed the, obviously I absolutely hated that school for the kids that went there. The people that went there were absolutely horrific. They were like even worse. Like having private school kids is one thing, but having like really, really like creative private school kids who all have like celebrity parents was like horrible. But the actual like doing of the art and like going, spending all day working on music, art, or what other subjects did I do? English. Doing those things every day made me really way more rewarded than doing normal subjects and normal lessons and normal stuff like that. So I feel like I had a huge opportunity. I was put into like the conditions of people that all were like potentially going to go off and have huge careers and stuff in that school. And I feel like really lucky for that education. And I think there's a lot of people that would have loved to have gone to an art school. And I think like that was one of the only places where I feel like I got the best out of myself, or like I learned a lot.
Were you confident?
No. And also they were so socially, like advanced there, because they were all just like these kind of London girlies who are all like basically just like mean girl bullies. And I was like a complete outsider there. And I couldn't, to be honest, I couldn't keep up with the dialogue. I just wasn't like astute enough or fast enough or bitchy enough or social climbing enough to like fight off these kind of like sociopaths that were at this school.
Did that drive you though?
In a way, yeah. I feel like I sort of avenge a part of like my needs in a sense, because I get to kind of like go and do all the things that like that I know that they said that they thought that they could do, and like I know I've done it. I know that sounds like really narcissistic, but there's something in it, Ben. I felt like an outsider. Like, I grew up in Crawley. Like, yeah, I went to private school, but also it's on complicated conditions. I don't feel too confident going into too deeply, but, you know, I grew up in a normal estate, like Privet Drive in Crawley, like so middle class. My education was paid for by my dad. When I went to university, I went from being a private school educated kid to being on the highest benefit that you could be on for university. So I was constantly just like never fitting in. I couldn't fit in with these really, really rich kids at this private school because I wasn't living that life. And then I couldn't really, and then when I went into normal, like when I went to work at TGI Fridays on the weekend, I was like this girl that went to this like school that everyone else that was 17 that was working with me was like having babies and had heroin addicts for parents. Do you know what I mean? It was a really weird intersect of like two cultures. And like now I look back on it, I think weirdly it's really nice to have both of those perspectives, because A, I get the privilege of having the education and that is my privilege, but also I get to have that privilege without having the sort of like sheltered like middle class lens. Like, also got to see like what real work was like. And, you know, like my mom, she was a teacher at a disabled school. She was on like, you know, she was a single parent. Dad was kind of nowhere to be seen. So it's a rare perspective to have held. And now, you know, when I was saying like there's so many private school kids in London, I find them fascinating because, especially in the music industry, I wonder to them, I'm thinking, oh, like, did I know a version of you at school? And were you that mean kids, or were you the ones that were like locked in the cupboards like I was? Do you know what I mean? Like, it depends on what experience they had. But I find it honestly quite interesting sometimes. Some people I speak to and they said that they loved it. Like, I went to uni with a girl who went to a school similar to mine, and she said, oh, don't you just miss being back there and being like ruling the school? And I was like, fucking hell no. And also, like, I wasn't that person, so like I don't know like where that comes from. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think having
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
coming from either a middle class or upper class background has its advantages in the creative industries?
I think, yeah, because I think people, I think creativity is a middle class sport. In reality, it's like, you know, Jimi Hendrix was supported by his rich girlfriend's family. Like, we're all, artists have like historically been propped up by these kind of privileges that have, you have to depend on in a way to create your art. And it's like, you know, even looking at me, my career is like, hey, I had an amazing education. I know so many people in the industry, probably more so than a kid that's working class. And then having the ability to stay and live at my mum's house, like having a bedroom at my mum's house that I could take up for my 20s was absolutely like undeniably useful in terms of like being able to go to London and go and work in a studio and do all the shit that I need to do, go on tour. Like, you can't go on tour if you're going to miss work and you can't make rent.
Yeah.
Like, it's such a impossibly hard thing to do. It's impossibly hard thing to do anyway. Like, music is insanely underpaid. So it definitely needs that.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me about the first song you remember buying from a record store, please, Izzy.
So I can't explicitly take credit for buying it because I definitely just drew a picture of it and asked my mum to go and buy it. But it was actually Spice, the record by Spice Girls, but to specific a song from that, because I don't know if I had singles and albums always. I'd just get the album if I could. Mm-hmm. It would be Wannabe by the Spice Girls. Yeah, and I tried drawing a picture of the Spice Girls and gave it to my mum to go and get it from the shop.
Did she get it from the drawing?
She got it. She got it. I think she had to ask someone in the shop. I also did it with Shania Twain as well. Everyone had Shania Twain and I drew a picture of her. And my mum would constantly be going to the shop to buy me these records that I'd drawn.
Shania Twain don't look too dissimilar from Enya. You could have been in a bit of a situation there, but thankfully went for Spice.
Yeah, thank God.
Tell me about, you hear multiple, you know, musicians talk about, you know, growing up in the 90s and them sort of formative years and the impact that seeing five women take over the world had on them. Like, what kind of impact did the Spice Girls have on you?
For me, it was like, it just felt like I'd seen something in myself. Like, I was even too young to even, I didn't even know how it took such a grip of me, but it was immediate. And it was like, I guess it was like a mirror thing of, you know, we would play at lunch playtime, and everyone would pick which Spice Girl that they would be. And I would always be Baby Spice. Everyone wanted to be sporty. Baby was like second or third, maybe. Scary was after that. No one wanted to be Victoria because she was boring. Let's face it, she's probably the most boring Spice Girl. I said it. Hold it against me.
Fantastic. Tell me about clubbing, and I want to know for track five, the song that soundtracked it. Where was clubbing? Was it kind of neon clad, you know, house and dance music venues? Was it, you know, sleazy indie clubs? What was it? Where was clubbing, Izzy?
Yeah, interesting question. That clubbing for me is a short-lived career, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It was usually in Brighton, and it would be the clubbing that I would do in Brighton wasn't necessarily the clubbing that I enjoyed, but it was a really big era where we would go to this place. At the time, it was called The Font, but now it's a Wetherspoons, I think, or like something similar. And then Honey Club, it was called. My brother would sneak me in there underage using his friend Jenny's ID. And that was fun, but I hated the music. I hated all of it. It was, clubbing was this thing like the whole time as a teenager, it was like, we're going to go clubbing and it's going to be the best thing ever. And then you'd like get to a club and be like, what the hell is this? This is sensory hell and the music sucks. Because it was always just like, it was it kind of pop music, I guess. But the clubbing that I remember loving that really changed me was going to see Justice in, I think it was Oxford. And we snuck out to go and do it. Or we said that we were going to go somewhere near. And then we got a train to, a coach to Oxford. And then went to Justice. And we were underage. And I remember it just feeling so illegal. The whole thing was really exciting. And just like coming in and having like drank like a mixture of vodka that I'd poured out of my parents' liquor. You know, when you take a little bit of each, like every little bottle.
We've all done it.
Yeah, like the classic. Like I was there, I was really like tezzed up to the nines, probably with all my eyeliner on, thinking that I was like fresh, like indie Cindy Han. And going to see Justice and it being like this massive, like cross, just like, bang! And then being like, feeling like, oh, I feel it now. Like I understood the whole like electricity of everything. And the sort of magic that held.
It shook up everything, though. I think, you know, people don't sort of reference Justice that much anymore. And I think the impact that they had on, and you know, the whole sort of Ed Banger scene, like, completely reshaped what was going on in guitar music at that point. Because literally, after then, Justice were literally remixing everybody. And there was so much stuff coming out on Kitsune and Ed Banger that was just absolutely fantastic and different and fresh, and it was just kind of making indie music really danceable, and it just kind of shook up the indie clubs as well. I thought it was a really fantastic time. I think Justice were absolute trailblazers there as well.
Yeah, I think as well it gave gateway to like the second wave of Daft Punk. Like, in that thing for me was that Daft Punk I'd always known from the earlier stuff, but then they kind of, I sort of got back in, I got more into Daft Punk when I understood Justice and understanding like electronic rock music in that respect of like when, like learning that they sampled like Metallica to get their sounds. And I never heard what rock music sounded like as electronic before. It was just something I'd never, ever heard any rock music like that. And it was just like, what the fuck is this? Like, so intense. And also like, in that sort of the time of it feeling kind of post Skins or whatever, it was that kind of feeling of there was something like a bit rebellious about it, like a bit, so something really exciting. And I think also I do still hear it. I know you said it, we don't hear it as much, or people don't reference it as much, but you know, there's a Dua Lipa track out recently that I thought, oh, that's a Justice song, or like I can hear it in way people sample, or when anyone does try to say anything sort of Daft Punk Justice sounding, I can hear it straight away and be like, oh, that's what they're referencing. Or like when rock bands do, I'm sure like for production sounds and stuff, people are doing a lot of like, how do we get that kick sound, or like how did they make that? I think that I guess we get a lot of producer artists now, but maybe it's the first time we really saw like produced rock music.
Yeah,
it was really exciting.
Izzy, I'm going to ask you for track six to tell me a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
So my home county artist is The Cure, and the song is Friday I'm in Love, because The Cure are from Crawley, which is my hometown. Mm-hmm. And I have I relate to The Cure. There's like a meme of like Robert Smith online, someone be like, oh, do you love Crawley? We came from, he's like, no, it's shit, it's a shithole. And I like feel him, like when I walk around Crawley, like I feel like Robert Smith is like in my bones. I'm like, hun, I've got you. Like, it's like having a guide through this, feeling like the alien, feeling like a razor head in the space. Because you know, in Crawley I get like egged in the street for like wearing my flares around, and like that TGI Fridays was the one that I worked in for like years.
Yeah.
And it was just like, people get like stabbed. People got stabbed outside. Like, it was gnarly. Like, all of our kitchen were like illegal immigrants. We had, it's like, it's a rough town. Like, it's supposedly that they said that when there was like, I don't know if this is a rumor, but I heard once that there was like, when they built Crawley before, obviously Gatwick Airport was a whole thing. It was like when the prisons in Croydon got like overfilled, they like moved them all to Crawley. So that's why we had such like a rough like crime problem and stuff there. Now it's obviously just like this middle class place because of its connections to London and Brighton, and it's like got an airport and everyone works in the airport. But from like to know that The Cure made what they made, and like also they rehearsed in Brighton Electric as well, which is like where we rehearsed for years. Like having that, having just like a great artist and having a sort of semi like weird parallel universe experience as them, it's a really nice feeling, because it's a shithole. It's a total shithole, and like I would not recommend anyone visiting there. Also Ramesh Ranganathan's from there too.
Ramesh is from there. He is. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. We tweeted him when we got top 10. We were like, are we there with the Crawley greats with Ramesh and The Cure? And he retweeted it, which was cool.
Tell me about, because, you know, wherever you grow up, I think, you know, you do gravitate towards the bands from your area. You know, coming from Essex, we're born to love Depeche Mode. We're born to love The Prodigy. You know, they're our hometown heroes. You know, at what point did you start to discover the Cure, and what was the music of theirs that kind of sort of pulled you in and towards them?
To be honest, it was way later on. It was in Brighton times when I really discovered them, because I knew that they were like this heritage artist and there was something that existed in the background, but I never really, I think it was more like when I started listening to like Jesus and Mary Chain, maybe in like that section of the 80s, where I then suddenly started to like thread together all of this other sort of stuff, that The Cure kind of comes back into the dialogue, and how it's really interesting that they kind of traversed pop music with all of the things that were happening at the time. And then there was this kid in Brighton that like knew them, and they were kind of around, like, because they were rehearsing in the studio, obviously. So then I'd listen to them more because of that. And then was like, oh shit, they're from Crawley. And then suddenly I felt this kinship after this whole like long-winded circle of figuring them out, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. For the last track, I'm going to ask you to tell me a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
I can't remember what I wrote on this one. So let me just check. Oh yeah, okay, so this is Mizzaloo, the original version, and I think it's really cool because I think this song's really important to me, and it was a really interesting discovery of, I love finding songs and finding like how many covers have happened through history, and at what point you connect with what cover, and then you can kind of like zone in on historically the value of something. So obviously, this is the song that I probably first came around in the like Kill Bill era, or like the Black Eyed Peas, pump it louder, da 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 da, which is like such a central point to how I like my perspective on how I see like Black Honey and the world that I create. And I find this song really interesting to then go, okay, so like Dick Dale, and then like obviously like the Dick Dale version, I realized really quickly was like the thing that inspired me the most, the surf tones, the way that it was done, the way it had this like old ancient kind of scale thing in it that sounded like from another world. And then you trace it back to this version and several others, and you hear that it's actually been some sort of like backdrop to music for years and years and years, in the same way that blues does. You know, some of the my favorite blues songs are like, you know, St. James Infirmary, or like I love so many different versions of that throughout history, and I find that so magical that we're at this in the history of the universe, we're at such an early point in the development of modern recording that it's going to be so wild to see like in hundreds and thousands of years what does stand the test of time, and what will be like Shakespeare of music? Will it be the Beatles, or like will it be some other version of it? Or
well, Lizzie, we make it very easy for people to go and listen to that alongside all of the other tracks that you've picked today, and obviously Black Honey's music as well, because we put together a little Spotify playlist to accompany the pod that everyone can go and listen to. Let's talk Black Honey. What's happening?
So currently we are working towards our biggest headline dates to come. So we're doing Brighton, Bristol, Leeds and London, just on a short little run, but they're bigger shows. So we're doing like Kentish Town Forum, and that's quite scary big, I guess, for us, but really exciting. And we just came off tour at the end of last year with this band Greta Van Fleet. That was awesome. We did like some big arenas and stuff with them. And then, yeah, we put a song out, Lemonade, recently. Then next up, we've got like festivals coming through, which will be announced soon. And we're going to be getting back into working on some new stuff, I think. Been taking a bit of a hole in this January.
And Izzy, if people want to kind of keep up to speed with all of that, where's the best place to follow all things Black Honey?
Definitely Spotify. That will have like all the music and it will have all the upcoming dates and stuff, but also Instagram, social media.
Okay. Well, if it's all right with you, when we release this episode, we'll tag Izzy in it. So anybody that's listening to this that has yet to discover your music, we'll make it nice and easy for them to go and listen.
Yeah, awesome.
Fantastic. Izzy, thank you so much for coming on today, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. I'm going to press stop. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. That was Izzy of Black Honey. Go check out Black Honey. Kind of a lovely little sort of throwback. If you've not heard their music before, kind of I can hear the Breeders in it. I can hear Hull. I can hear lots of kind of really cool, trashy 90s kind of American guitar stuff. I can hear Pixies in it. All that good stuff. And so go check them out. Go check out Lemonade. It's a fantastic single. I'll put it on the playlist that you can go and check out on Spotify. Why not go and support us on Patreon? Head over to there, patreon.com/offthebeatandtrack. Show your love for this pod. It costs you 75 pence a month. What's that work out? 20p a week? Less than 20p a week. And it all goes in the pot to keep these podcasts coming your way. I've got no sponsors, no backers, and it was all just done for the love. So anything that goes back in the pot is fantastic. I think we're done. I'll see you next time. Thanks ever so much for listening. Love you lots. Bye-bye.